Okay, so I think we will look at it straight away now and then have questions and processing time just afterwards. So, I've called this one It's All About Jesus, which sounds quite simple and obvious, but actually I think is a really helpful phrase for our lives. That's why I've did it. For remembering like everything, all the stories we've shared, his capacity to comfort us with the comfort he's received, to help us in our overcoming, to be in the details, to be in the drama. It is all about Jesus. And we see that it's introduced in a new way in chapter 5. If chapter 4 is about God as creator, then we see chapter 5 is God reveals himself through Jesus as redeemer. Why do we need Jesus? Well, I think there are two parts to this chapter. One is about sort of who he is and what he's done. And then the second half is the implication that has for us who believe in him, anyone who believes in him from any tribe, language, people, or nation. So, firstly, I've written this in the notes that the world is in crisis. It always has been, and in this age, it always will be. There is this extraordinary tension. I don't know if you ever feel this, wherever you go, between the wonder, the beauty, the ingenuity of creation, the created order, and particularly humans, have phenomenal ingenuity and capacity and vision and what we do with natural resources and we create cities. I mean, just phenomenal. And our capacity to investigate and steward, understand how our bodies work. Just there is a magnificence about us and there's a magnificence about creation. And yet it is always at odds with this sort of darkness, this toxicity, this oppression. There's always hunger, there's always violence, there's always sorrow, there's always struggle, and there's always death. And it's this bizarre juxtaposition. And I read English literature at uni, and so I think in the arts an amazing at expressing that. But I really found that in everything I looked at and read about and thought about, this tension within the human condition of our greatness, and also just the toughness and the brutality of it as well, of living on this earth. And even for us, where there's incredible material comforts like we've never had before, the guarantee that most children will live now above the age of 5, whereas 50% mortality, certainly in Greco-Roman culture and probably in some parts of the world still today. And incredible interventions medically, nutritionally, even education, so many levels. And yet still people aren't, they still find it hard to just be happy, like you were saying, just having a nice day. Still doesn't seem to be a given, and it's an extraordinary tension. What I find interesting is Star Wars. It grips me because there's something about it that seems to reflect a yin yang approach to reality, which is there's darkness, there is light, but we're not really sure who's going to win. It's a bit close, and some people were dark and become light, and some people are light and become dark, and we're like, oh gosh, I don't know if this is going to work out okay, actually. I don't know if the force or whatever is strong enough, if the light side is strong enough, if some people even want to be on that side. And there's this sort of almost underlying mindset within that, and in a reading of the world, a material reading of the world, that is evil seems to be triumphing, or at least able to. At least it's kind of there. It has an incredible power. And at this thought, John, who writes Revelation, weeps and weeps. Can anyone deal with this issue of the problem in the world? Can anyone deal with this issue of the problem in me? Because I think when we face the problem out there, and I've noted it here, Tom Wright does an excellent commentary on Revelation. He talks about that thing where you look at the evil out there. And then you reduce it and you reduce it and you reduce, and you suddenly think, it's actually in me too. Actually, in my inability to just be happy with myself, my inability to really absolutely love with passion and devotion those closest to me, the inability to just be just flowing in patience and gentleness all the time. to be jealous about things that you just know rationally don't merit jealousy.
Just
that thing out there is in me and I'm not worthy either. I'm not doing myself down. I'm just being realistic, like a healthy diagnosis of myself.
You know that G.K. Chesterton letter, don't you?
No, I don't. G.K. Chesterton really? Letter from really? Sarah Rees, just for the recording.
So it's really famous.
Yeah. Yeah, go for it.
This is years and years ago. Like, there was like a letter writing things at the time.
To speak into that. G.K. Chesterton.
Right, lost my track. So there was a competition. People had to write in letters about what's on the theme of what's wrong with the world. And he just wrote, "Dear Sir, I am."
Yeah. Well, that's it. That's exactly it. He's really sharp, G.K. Chesterton. He was really. That's brilliant. That's exactly it. And so anyway, John's weeping. And I mean, that's a brilliant example there. And I'm sure we've all had those moments where we're like, if I'm honest, I know that I'm a contributory factor. I certainly know I don't have capacity or authority to stop it and change it. And then right in the middle of it, someone says, one of the elders, "Don't weep. The lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has triumphed." He's able to just deal with all the problems in the world. And basically the rest of Revelation will be looking at what that looks like. But he is able to just deal with it all. He can actually absolutely fundamentally identify this issue of the root of evil, uproot it and replace it and realign everything. Those words to the Jewish reader and to the Gentile reader who was knowledgeable about Jewish scriptures are messianic titles. The line of the tribe of Judah and the root of David were both known to be some sort of figure coming out of Israel who would bring some sort of deliverance. So when John quotes that the elder says this, they're saying there's a Messiah and he has triumphed. And then the most extraordinary statement, he sees a lamb. Now, this is mentioned 29 times in Revelation, a sacrificial lamb, only once in the rest of the New Testament. And what it again does to the Jewish reader and the well-versed Gentile reader is reminds them of an Exodus, a time for us now, 3,500 years ago, so for them about 1,500 years ago, where there was an oppressed people in slavery, and in order to be delivered from their slavery and pass through, miraculously pass through the Red Sea and become a people, the Exodus, that is a coming out of, they had to be marked in some form of way of protection against an angel of death sent to bring God's justice to the Egyptians who'd been oppressing them. A lamb was slain and the blood was put on the doorposts of every Israelite family. When the angel of death came, those families were spared. And that broke the final, the 10, if you like, plagues of the Exodus. If you want to read it, going back into the book of Exodus, represented 10 key gods of Egyptian culture. And the top god was Ra, the son of God. The pharaohs were seen as God themselves. And when the son of God, the son of Pharaoh, died, that was their final big god being exposed and demolished. And God, the God of heaven and earth, and God of Israel, being revealed as the true and living God. And at that point, Pharaoh broke and finally let them, after increasingly 400 years of increased oppression and certainly incredible oppression for at least 40 years in slavery and incredible cries for justice and incredible refusal to release them, that broke him and he finally releases them. And so whenever a Jewish reader will hear about a lamb being slain, they will remember that first Exodus. There is a moment where, against all the odds, they were released from oppression into a new humanity, into a new tribe, into a people.
Can I just say how much I
love
this group?
Oh, Kat. Kat, that's so encouraging. Thank you. So right in the middle of this weeping that the world is in a mess and there's nothing we can do about it. It seems to just go on and on and on. There's nothing we can do about it. Suddenly, there's this... Actually, there was always someone who was going to come. Judah, the root of Judah. I mean, he was prophesied about in Genesis. Then there's this Exodus they've already got in their mind. They celebrate every year with the Passover in their thinking. It's this massive... it's just a massive rite of passage that every Jewish family goes through. And then suddenly... John is using the language of the Messiah, of the Exodus, and saying there is actually going to be a fundamental deliverance of the human condition out of this oppression into newness of life. There's going to be a fundamental transformation, much bigger than that was. And these, if you like, and I think this is a helpful analogy for looking at the rest of the next few chapters, which are pretty tough in Revelation, of a sort of labour, the momentum of labour pains, which are tormenting, but actually have a momentum to release life, just as those 10 plagues were a momentum releasing life. And any Egyptian family who wanted to go with the Israelites was released to go in that Exodus. If they had the faith that actually this was where the people of faith were, they could leave and go with them. So there's this joyful recognition that a Messiah, a lamb, the root of David, the line of Judah, he has triumphed. This man, this Israelite, Jesus, he has triumphed. He as a human did not allow evil ever to take root in his heart. And he was able, therefore, not only to be a spotless presentation, a blameless presentation of humanity, but in his death, that evil died, that was put to death, that was crucified. And in his resurrection from the death, a new righteousness was available to all of humanity. So Jesus is worthy because no evil ever took root in his heart. And moreover, in his sacrificial death, the very root of evil itself is destroyed. It's very, very hard to really grasp the good news before we connect emotionally with the bad news. It's like a bit like a doctor has to give, they give the diagnosis. And that's tough to hear, but you need to hear it before you're then given the solution. Otherwise, you don't understand the need for the solution. It makes no sense and you wouldn't go down that route. So the bad news is there is no one who is worthy. And the good news is actually there was one. There was one who is worthy. But as I said, I see this as two halves in this chapter. And what's really exciting for us as believers is what then that does to the human condition. So the story doesn't end there. Jesus not only destroys the root of evil in everyone who believes in him, but he also replaces that root with a new root of righteousness. So I love Paul's words. Some of my favourite words is this great memory verse if you want to learn about your new status in Christ, Galatians 2:20. I have been crucified with Christ, and I, that is that toxic, selfish, self-focused human nature, no longer lives, but Christ lives in me. The life I now live in the body, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. And why we've put the image of the butterfly in is we not only define ourselves as saved sinners, and one of my bugbears with certain aspects of recovery is when people define themselves by their addiction. It's a complete lie. We are not defined by lies anymore of who we are, weren't, or who we once were in our old natures. We are defined as holy now, literally saints, hagio, holy ones. That is our definition. When we're looked at from God, when he looks at us, he calls us holy, he sees us as that. That is our status, and it's out of that identity that we can live. So we're not saved sinners. We're holy ones. We're not caterpillars desperately trying to imitate a butterfly. We have actually fundamentally been put to death, and I think the cocoon's a helpful grave image, and we've re-emerged as a butterfly. We live in a three-dimensional, not two-dimensional plane. And we are totally different natures now to our old nature. And there's some wonderful ways that this shows. Our prayers are heard. Our prayers are heard. Every prayer we pray, every tear we cry, every time we're happy and we know in our hearts because God's given us something. Every testimony said that's heard. It's incense. It's right there. It's very close and very precious to him. we sing a new song. And I love Chris Vallotton talked about often with a new season comes a new song. So it's not just, oh, it's a new song. It's actually a whole new way of life. And it requires a new song. We're a kingdom. Now, this would have been really exciting for the, again, the Jewish reader, because the Israelites were designed to be a kingdom of light, to show the world what God was like and be a blessing. And because of the toxicity, they couldn't overcome, even with the law they were given and so many things. They weren't able to be that kingdom. But now Jewish believers in Jesus and any Gentile believers who join them are finally able to be that kingdom, to show the world what God is like and how good and kind and generous he is. And when we come under his governance, how life works. They're from every tribe, language, people and nation. And one of the, Chris, and my favourite things in the world is we meet brothers and sisters from anywhere. And we can't even speak the same language sometimes, but we know we're family. And it is the most stunning, beautiful thing. There is no tribe, language, people or nation that won't have people who just know that Jesus has taken out that root and replaced it and given them a new nature. And we're priests now, we're designed to serve God, and it's such a liberation. Self-serving, a self-serving life is such a life of bondage. It's so oppressive to be constantly trying to serve yourself. It just doesn't work. And we're now finally able, and we're released to serve him. And that's where life comes from, and that's how life flows. And we represent him well to the earth. There are lovely terms in Romans, like we're ambassadors. We can live life as if we know that we come from another country, but we represent him well here. And we give a good account, and we're wise, and we're gentle, and we're winsome in the way we represent him. We are his light in the world now. And we will reign forever and ever. And that victory starts now. Some of our stories have been talking about how we are in victory. We're in victory over our flesh. We're in victory over the world system. And we're in victory over the enemy who seeks to rob, kill, and destroy. We can enter into that. And finally, and most importantly, we're worshippers. And if you almost forget everything else, just that one thing, it's all about Jesus. Whether we're sad, whether we're happy, whether we're praying for something, whether we've received something, we can have that posture of honour to him. It's all about Jesus. And that kind of brings us through, doesn't it? It brings us into peace. And what I love about this is Jesus' death is not just a theoretical solution to a theoretical problem. We have a lot of theory, don't we? And a lot of an analysis in our culture, and a lot of all the stats of how people live and this and that and the other, and how are we going to problem solve? This is fundamentally practical, because if the problem is an old nature and the solution is a new nature, that's going to work. So the human condition, once self-serving, now becomes like Christ, means that actually culture can be transformed, because a whole movement of people can stop persecuting one another and be kind, stop being violent and start to love, stop oppressing and start to be free. Where there's hunger, fullness and abundance and provision. Where there's sorrow, people can become joyful. And where there's that struggle, people find their peace. And where there's death, life comes. And we know life, we can experience life even in this temporal age more fully. And of course, in the age to come, which we come to at the end of Revelation, eternal life. I'm just going to read out a couple of, I found, really helpful synopsis. This is the Lion Handbook. Just says a sentence about chapter 5, the sealed scroll. The scroll contains the world's destiny revealed to John in a series of pictures, which we'll come to. Only Christ has the right to set these things in motion, not by virtue of his power, the lion, but through his sacrificial death, the slain lamb. Chapter 4 pictured God the Creator. This chapter pictures God as the Redeemer. And the response to both is universal praise and worship. And then this one in the Collins Handbook as well. At the centre of worship is Christ the Lamb, who is praised because his sacrificial death has given him authority to open the scroll which holds God's purposes for the future. And so that's our takeaway. Our takeaway is that the centre of everything of truth and reality is the praise and worship of the Lamb, and for us to enter more and more into truth and reality and freedom, it's for us to enter more and more into that place of worship of him.